Ooh, amen. Good morning, church. It is good to be here with you. It's been a kind of a busy time, and so much to be thankful for. So much to be thankful. When Russ was sharing this morning about the way we gave over this past year towards benevolence, and we started thinking about things even outside, above and beyond the 80,000, just in those things. And it's just amazing to be a part of a group of Christians who frankly put their money where their mouth is, who believe in something enough to do something about it. So I thank you all for living worthy of the calling. I looked it up, and it was actually seven. I took pictures of seven guys getting baptized Wednesday night. So Derek, we split the difference here. We split the difference. We're both right or both wrong, depending on how you want to look at it. So I prefer to think we're both right. So that was a great thing to see that Wednesday night, to see those guys come into faith, and the great work that that Caleb is doing in that ministry as those guys begin a new phase in life, a new way of living. It's been a busy time in the community as well. Some of you are, I know, involved in the Mac production of the Christmas Carol. You may notice Jonathan Tucker's. Just notice him. That's all. That's right. But he's not the only one. There are others who have been involved in that. The Westwood Middle School. If you are sitting by Mike and Karen Lewis this morning and notice them nodding off during the sermon, feel free to give them a gentle nudge, because they worked hard until late at night getting that production wrapped up last night. So much going on around this Christmas season. The Remembrance Tree, so thankful. I think Jerry Kreitz helped put this together already. We have some ornaments up here with names written on them. If there's somebody that you want to remember and make that a part of our tree, we encourage you to do that with a picture or an ornament. We want this to be a time to remember those who have gone before us. Maybe it was someone who helped bring you to faith in Christ, but we want to certainly take time to honor those who have gone before us. I heard a story on this week on the radio, and they did sort of a Christmas, it was really an art rave, but this kind of installation, it was really unusual. And what made this particular art gathering unusual wasn't the art itself, though that's certainly, you know, different by most of our standards, but it wasn't the art itself that made this particular installation unusual. What made it unusual was its location. It was located, it was done in Pripyat, Ukraine. Now, if that doesn't ring a bell for some of you, that's understandable, because it's been over 30 years since Pripyat first came to the world's attention. Pripyat was the home of the Chernobyl nuclear power plant. And when that reactor melted down and exploded, the city of Pripyat and all the surrounding countryside, several villages, became what's known as an exclusion zone. People weren't supposed to live in there. And over the past three decades, nature has come to gradually reclaim the city of Pripyat, a once thriving city, once home to about 50,000 residents, and today it remains completely uninhabited, though it has recently opened its doors to short-term tourists. You can only stay in there so long, and you have to stay in certain areas. There are all these things. You can't touch anything. And in the blink of an eye, all the people who lived there, everyone and everything in that area, it immediately became contaminated. That's a floor full of gas masks that were no longer usable because they too were contaminated. But they all became contaminated from the nuclear fallout. So if you go for a visit, and you can go for a really short term, you have to stay in certain areas and only relegate yourself to certain activities. Now, unlike the cartoons or the movies, the victims of Chernobyl didn't actually glow in the dark. They did not gain supernatural powers. Rather, inside of them, they carried the seeds of sickness and cancer and death, never knowing when or where those seeds would sprout. Now, at first, the residents of Pripyat were told they knew something had happened. I mean, it was very evident. You could see it. Everyone was up all the night watching the power plant melt down. They said they never knew that death could be so beautiful. But they were told at first that we're going to evacuate everyone. You'll just be gone for 3 days, and we're going to wash everything down. We're going to clean everything. So that's where they were told. The kids carried their school books because they'd need to study while they were away. But it quickly became apparent that more was going on. The incident changed them forever. And when the army loaded everyone onto buses, this is one mother's account of their experience. This is one of the residents who's gone back 30 years later to her apartment. And this is one mother's account of what happened. She said, "From the very first, I felt that we were Chernobylites, that we were already a separate people. Our bus stopped in a village, and people slept on the floor in a school, others in a club. There was nowhere to go. One woman invited us to sleep at her house. 'Come,' she said, 'I'll put some linen down for you. I feel bad for your boy.' Her friends started dragging her away from us. 'Are you crazy? They're contaminated.' When we settled in Mogilev and our son started school, he came back the very first day in tears. They put him next to a girl who said she didn't want to sit with him. He was radioactive. Our son was in the fourth grade, and he was the only one from Chernobyl in the class. The other kids were afraid of him. They called him Shiny. His childhood ended so early." Can you imagine? From that day forward, everyone in and around Chernobyl and their children and eventually even their grandchildren, by the way, because this is passed down genetically. That's one of the real dangers of nuclear fallout. It changed your genetic material. And so it changed generations forever. And they were immediately unwelcomed in their homes. One woman talked about how she fled to her sister's house, and her sister would not open the door to her. And so they had to sleep at a bus station. But her sister was afraid because she was nursing her child. She didn't want to get her baby sick. And so they were unwelcomed by their families. They were rejected in their new homes. They were left to fend for themselves as best they could. As a matter of fact, some people, against the government's recommendation, have just moved back. They lived in a small village, and they've just gone back because they're not welcomed anywhere else. And they said, "If somebody offers us a vegetable from their gardens, we just eat it. We don't say anything about it because we know, we just know. And if we were to try to leave at this point, we know the government would put up a police cordon and block us off. But we're not welcomed anywhere else." What is it that makes a person untouchable? Sometimes it's race. Sometimes it's the color of skin or language or nationality or religion. Sometimes it's poverty. Type of clothing you wear, or personal hygiene. Sometimes it's actual disease or disfigurement. Think of the AIDS crisis just a generation ago. But even cancer or even addiction tend to make people separate and apart and untouchable. What they all have in common is one thing. It's fear. People are afraid of you. Afraid that you'll do something to them. Afraid that just by being near you, that you'll contaminate them. In Jesus' day, it was leprosy that marked you as untouchable. It was incurable. It was untreatable. It was contagious. And it was fatal. And as we continue our study through the Gospel of Mark, we need to see how Jesus responds to the untouchable. It says, and a leper came to him, entreating him and kneeling down, saying to him, "If you're willing, you can make me clean." Now pay attention to this, because this may be different than your translations. We'll talk about it here in a little bit. And becoming angry, he stretched out his hand and touched him. And he said to him, "I am willing. Be made clean." And immediately the leprosy went away from him and he was clean. and warning him sternly. He sent him away at once, and he said, "See to it that you say nothing to anyone, but go show yourself to the priest and bring for your cleansing the things which Moses commanded for a testimony to them." But he went out and began to proclaim it freely and to spread abroad the account, so that he was no longer able to enter publicly into a town. But he was staying outside in deserted places, and they were coming to him from all directions. Now, this is a translation that I've never used before, but I found it's called the Lexingham English Bible, and I chose it for a specific reason. If you had almost any other version, the NIV will interpret it something like this, but almost any other version of the Bible, you'll notice some pretty striking differences, which we'll talk about in just a minute. But let's start off by talking about leprosy. To be clear, when the Bible talks about leprosy, it's not specifically Hansen's disease, which is what we call leprosy today, though it included that. But leprosy included a whole range of skin diseases. And Leviticus, if you go back to Leviticus chapters 13 and 14, they give some really specific instructions to the priest. The priests are the ones who diagnose you. You had a skin problem, you go to the priest, and they look at it, and if it does this, you're okay, or it'll go away, and if it does that, then you're unclean, you're defiled. It's a defiling disease. And if that disease was defiling, if you, whatever you had fell into that range of diseases that was considered defiling, this is what the Levitical law said was supposed to happen. It says, anyone with such a defiling disease must wear torn clothes, let their hair be unkempt, cover the lower part of their face, and cry out, "Unclean, unclean." As long as they have the disease, they must remain unclean, and they must live alone. They must live outside the camp. And additionally, what's even more than this, which sounds terrible, and this is terrible, but even more than this, leprosy was associated with sin. You go through the Old Testament and you see people who sin, they get leprosy, like Miriam, Moses' sister. Remember, when she and Aaron were kind of conspiring behind Moses' back, and she was struck with leprosy. And then later, Elisha's servant, who went behind his back to Naaman to accept the gift that Naaman was trying to offer Elisha, and he went and took it. Gehazi was his name. And Gehazi, because he lied about it and he took this gift that he wasn't supposed to take, he was struck with leprosy. And of course, there's King Uzziah. They were all struck with these skin diseases, these defiling skin diseases, because of their sin. So in addition to being like contagious, you're also unclean, because you obviously did something to get this, right? So this unnamed man has been living life entirely cut off from his family. I mean, he's completely isolated, cut off from his family, cut off from his friend, cut off from his community, all because of his perceived failings, because of something he's done wrong. Now, it is possible that he found something like this, a leper colony, a colony of untouchables to live with, but it's not the same. It's not the same at all. It's not even close. You're still exiled from everyone and everything you've ever known. And there may be people around you, but it's a community of the condemned, right? And one step outside that area lets you know that you're still not welcomed. One step outside that area reminds you of your separateness, of your contamination, of your uncleanness. And somehow, this guy, in his isolation, learns about Jesus' presence and power, and he risks everything in the desperate hope that this healer will be different than the rest, that he won't be a charlatan, he won't be a quack, he won't be a con artist like all of the others, that maybe this guy is for real. And so he dares to approach Jesus, which he's not supposed to do. He's breaking the law. He's supposed to stay away. Instead, he comes at Jesus. He falls down before him. Maybe he falls down a ways off, or maybe he dares to come even closer and fall actually at the feet of Jesus. But he falls down. He kneels at the feet of Jesus. And when he draws near, begging for Jesus' attention, begging for Jesus' mercy, begging to be made clean, begging for a chance at life, and Jesus responds in anger. That's so weird. Jesus responds in anger. Now, most of the translations, if you've looked it up by now, most of your translations are going to use the word compassion or even the word pity here, which totally makes sense in this scene based on what Jesus does. But the ancient manuscripts are divided. Some of them say compassion. Some of them say anger. And if you go, if you happen to, and I don't know this language at all, but if you were to go back to the language that Jesus originally spoke, you would see that those words are remarkably similar, just a few letters difference. What would be hard to imagine is that someone sees the word compassion and says, no, not compassion, this is anger. That's hard to imagine when the scribes are copying, and that's what happens generation after generation. It is easy to imagine and say, that must be wrong. This is not anger, this is compassion. Because Jesus does indeed exhibit compassion, right? He does what he does, shows compassion. But so it's because it's harder to understand, and because of the particular manuscripts we have with the word anger, scholars are generally agreed. Yeah, Jesus responds, it says in anger, and it doesn't make any sense, right? What's he angry at? Why would Jesus be angry? And Mark doesn't say. He doesn't give us any clues. But I can't help but think, maybe Jesus is angry with the way that this disease and death and disfigurement and defilement, maybe he's angry at the way these have ravaged this man's life. He sees what this man has gone through, and he's furious that the one he loves has had to endure that. That Jesus is furious, the same reason that Ukrainian mother was furious, because her son was an outcast and she saw the way it hurt him. Maybe that's why Jesus is angry. And in his anger, Jesus does indeed exhibit compassion. It's that furious, defensive compassion. The same compassion that you might exhibit if you saw a little child being picked on by bigger kids, right? Yes, you act in compassion to defend the child, but you're angry that they're enjoying this torment at this kid's expense. So Jesus indeed does act in his compassion, but he does the unthinkable in this anger. He reaches out and he touches the man. Now, and because these people, the witnesses, have all read the Levitical laws, the same Levitical laws we talked about earlier from Leviticus chapters 13 and 14, they know, everybody knows, what's just happened. Not only has Jesus exposed himself to a deadly, deadly, one of the most feared diseases in the world, but in the process, Jesus has become unclean because he's touched this guy. Except that he isn't. Instead of this man's uncleanness contaminating Jesus, the exact opposite has happened. Jesus' cleanness has contaminated this man. It's gone the opposite way. Every other time in the history of the world, if you touch somebody with leprosy, their uncleanness contaminated you. But this time, something's different, and Jesus' cleanness contaminates this man. And this man is not only immediately healed, he is immediately clean, the text says. Rather than recoiling in fear and giving in to the defensive, Jesus has gone on the offensive. He has invaded the domain of Satan, and he is reclaiming back its captives. Jesus knows that he has broken the laws here. He knows that because he knows the law better than you or I, right? But he is less concerned with demonstrating that he's a law keeper and more concerned with demonstrating and helping this leper re-enter society. That is his main goal. So he then sends this man on to Jerusalem to go through the ritual purification rites. Not because this guy needs to be clean. We already know he's clean, but everybody else needs to know he's clean. And you had to go through that in order to re-enter society, in order to go back to your family, in order to have a job, in order to live in community. You had to go through this. It was an eight-day process. So Jesus says, carry all that stuff, go, and you're going to be a witness to them to show that you're clean. I know you're clean. We know you're clean. We saw it happen, but they need to see it now. Because Jesus, that's his primary concern, is getting this man back into community, back into society, back into relationship, not only with other people, back into relationship with God, because he couldn't go and worship. And as the people of God, this is who we're following, right? This is we're disciples of this guy, which means we go where he goes, we do what he does, we say what he says. And as disciples of this Jesus, this is exactly what we're called to do, to go and be, as they were later told, salt and light, right? Substances, two substances that permeate and transform their environment. If you go into one dark room and you light one tiny light, it changes the entire room. Salt invades every aspect of the food, right? We're called at the church to go and reclaim our authority as salt and light, not to take a defensive stance. That is not our calling, cringing back at society's defiling encroachment on our values, on our beliefs. We're called to go on the offensive. We're called to go out there transforming the world through the unconditional and self-sacrificing love of God. That's what we're called to do. Rather than complaining about the world's defilement, we restore it to purity and wholeness by overcoming evil with good. That's what we're called to do. So this morning, of course, one question. We're going to close with this. We're going to make it quick. This morning, there's one question for you. Who do you fear? Who scares you? Is it prisoners? Is it immigrants? Is it AIDS victims? Because Jesus says these people are not to be feared. These people are no longer our enemies. They're our mission field. They're no longer who we fear. That's who we love. We are called to love the unlovable, to touch the untouchable, and in the process, spread the cleanness of the cross upon them. There is no one out there, no one out there, who doesn't deserve your love, your compassion, and your anger at their situation. Sometimes it's a situation of their own making. Oftentimes it's not. I don't know anybody who has chosen to live in abject poverty in a third world country. They just had the misfortune of being born there, and you had the fortune of being born here. I don't know anybody who's chosen the misfortune of being born disfigured. And you didn't choose the fortune of being born whole. I don't know anyone who chose to receive some of these diseases, and I didn't choose to be free of them. But you and I, by the way we interact, we get to spread the love of God. This morning, if you need encouragement, if you need strength, if you need to repent for the way you have treated the untouchable in the past, we want to offer prayers of forgiveness, prayers of healing. If you need encouragement, if you need strength, if we can help you at all, won't you come this morning while we stand and while we sing?